Hello, and welcome to Administrative Remedies, because you can't fix what you don't understand. Brought to you in part by the University of Tulsa College of Law. I'm Gwendolyn Savitz, an associate professor here at TU and the Associate Dean of Research and Intellectual Life.
And I'm Mark Rourke. I'm the Dean of the College of Law.
We'll be breaking down complex doctrines with real-life analogies and examples to demystify the world of administrative law for everyone trying to understand how government actually works.
Agencies are the main way the federal government gets things done. It's not through Congress, for reasons we'll be addressing over the course of this series.
All right, so Mark, let's say you're going out for the night, you've left the kids with the babysitter, and you said something like, feel free to use anything in the kitchen. What would you have meant?
I mean, like, stuff in the refrigerator, the microwave, the oven, maybe a blender if they're making cookies.
So you would be surprised if you came home and saw that she mounted a cutting board to the wall and was teaching your kids knife throwing.
I mean, I'd be impressed, actually, especially if they got more accurate with their knife throwing.
But what if they got less accurate with their knife throwing?
That would be a problem. It'd be a little scary, actually.
Or what if you told her to keep the house tidy and came home to find that she had purchased and installed a $6,000 organizing system in one of the kids' closets?
Well, if I'm being fair, their closets are really messy. But it depends on if I'm paying for it.
Oh, yes, you are.
If I'm paying for it, I would be absolutely livid. That would be very upsetting.
Sometimes the literal words of the directions that someone was given or the permission that someone was given can cover something, even though it really, really wasn't what you meant. Today, we are talking about the major question doctrine, and that is essentially the court saying, yes, the statute's words could technically cover that, but if Congress meant to let you do it, they would have been a lot clearer. So let's talk about how this played. So we are going back to 1996.
So just a question. Did the idea about major questions exist before the name?
Very much so. This is before the major questions doctrine was called the major questions doctrine. But I think this is the clearest way to think about how it began. We're talking about FDA v. Brown and Williamson. In this case, FDA looked at its statute, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and said, nicotine is a drug. Cigarettes are drug delivery devices. We have authority over those, so we can regulate tobacco.
That sounds logical.
It's definitely a fair reading of the statute. Look at the definition of a drug.
The term drug means articles, other than food, intended to affect the structure or any function of the body.
Under that, is nicotine a drug?
Absolutely. It's addictive. It changes brain chemistry.
Just like an asthma inhaler or an insulin injector is a device that delivers drugs to the body, cigarettes deliver nicotine. So case closed. FDA can regulate them, right?
I'm guessing where you're going is that they can't.
The tobacco company sued, and the Supreme Court said no.
Justice O'Connor said, we are confident that Congress could not have intended to delegate a decision of such economic and political significance to an agency in so cryptic a fashion. To find that the FDA has the authority to regulate tobacco products, one must not only adopt an extremely strained understanding of safety, as is used throughout the Act, a concept central to the FDCA's regulation scheme, but also ignore the plain implication of Congress's subsequent tobacco-specific legislation.
She's essentially explaining the logic of the doctrine there. She's not naming it, but the seed is planted. If this is some sort of huge economic decision, you're going to need clear congressional permission.
So then when did they actually name the major questions doctrine?
That wasn't until 2022. This is really new. This was in West Virginia v. EPA, and it's the first time they're explicitly using the label, although there had been cases that hinted at it on the shadow docket earlier.
This is a climate change case.
Yes. So in 2015, Obama's EPA issues the Clean Power Plan. It's supposed to reduce CO2 from power plants. But they didn't just require better technology at each plant. They required generation shifting, pushing the entire grid to move from coal towards natural gas and renewables.
So that sounds pretty massive.
It was. Here, read what the plan actually required.
So it says the best system for emissions reductions for existing plants included three types of measures, which the agency called building blocks. The first building block was heat rate improvements at coal-fired plants, essentially practices such plants could undertake to burn coal more efficiently. But such improvements, EPA stated, would lead only to small emission reductions because coal-fired power plants were already operating near optimum efficiency. On the agency's view, much larger emission reductions were needed from coal-fired plants to address climate change. So the agency included two additional building blocks in its BSER, both of which involve what are called generation shifting from higher emitting to lower emitting producers of electricity.
It's pretty dense, but what she's saying is the EPA is functionally restructuring the entire American electricity sector. However, this rule never took effect. Trump came into office and repealed it. Then Biden's EPA was considering something similar when the Supreme Court decided to step in.
So the court reviewed a dead rule.
They did, which alone upset a lot of people. The court wanted to settle the question and refused to let the case drop when it was no longer a live dispute.
Aren't there abstention doctrines that prevent the court from considering those kinds of cases?
There certainly should have been. This case was moot, but they forged ahead nevertheless.
Huh. So when Justice Roberts used this opinion to crystallize the major questions doctrine, he wrote, "In certain extraordinary cases, both separation of powers principles and practical understanding of legislative intent make us reluctant to read into ambiguous statutory text the delegation claimed to be lurking there. To convince us otherwise, something more than a merely plausible textual basis for the agency action is necessary. The agency instead must point to clear congressional authorization for the power it claims."
Importantly, he also used the name.
Our precedent counsels skepticism toward EPA's claim that Section 111 empowers it to devise carbon emission caps based on a generation shifting approach. To overcome that skepticism, the government must, under the major questions doctrine, point to a clear congressional authorization to regulate in that manner. All the government can offer, however, is the agency's authority to establish emissions caps at a level reflecting the application of the best system of emission reduction adequately demonstrated.
At this point, EPA is saying we need to establish the best system of emissions reductions for CO2 in general, which they had been explicitly ordered to do by the Supreme Court in Massachusetts EPA. And the best way we can do that is moving away from coal power plants. Per unit of heat, coal is a lot less efficient than natural gas, so it is not the most efficient way to generate heat to create electricity. But the court had major issues with this interpretation. Even if the text technically fits, like nicotine is a drug, it's not enough for transformative powers like this.
So Brown and Williamson was the birth, but West Virginia was the baptism.
Yes, now it has a name.
Well, okay. So how do we know what counts as a major question? What exactly is that test?
That is a crucial question, which nobody can really say for sure. The court has talked about several factors to consider, although they haven't given a clear test yet. Let's break down some of the main factors in both of the cases we just talked about.
Okay. The first factor, economic significance. In Brown and Williamson, it's the economic impact of the tobacco industry. It was massive, hundreds of billions of dollars.
Yes. So if we have some sort of economic impact in the billions, that's a major question. Now, let's look at West Virginia v. EPA and see what Roberts had to say about the economic impact there.
EPA's own modeling concluded that the rule would entail billions of dollars in compliance costs, raise electricity prices in every state, and eliminate tens of thousands of jobs across various sectors.
So both of these cases involve billions of dollars in fundamental economic restructuring. But it's not just about money. The next issue is there political significance? Does the issue generate significant political controversy?
Okay, tobacco regulation has always been politically explosive, and climate change is one of the most politically divisive issues of our time.
When an agency wades into some sort of political charged territory, like in these cases, using statutory language that wasn't just enacted to allow the agency to do that, that's another reason the court can determine it's a major question doctrine. The next factor is what the court's calling regulatory significance. Would this dramatically expand the agency's authority? So in Brown and Williamson, FDA had existed since 1906 and had never tried to claim authority over tobacco, but it suddenly claimed to discover this power after 90 years. That was suspicious. And in West Virginia, Roberts made the same point about the EPA. Here's what he said.
Prior to 2015, the EPA had always set emissions limits under Section 111 based on the application of measures that would reduce pollution by causing the regulated source to operate more cleanly. It had never devised a cap by looking into a system that would reduce pollution simply by shifting polluting activity from dirtier to cleaner sources.
Both agencies were trying to claim new powers based on old statutes. But it's important to note that in West Virginia, the court said it was absolutely fine for EPA to tell power plants that they needed to burn coal more cleanly themselves. That was sort of stage one of that three-step process. That part was fine. That's what they've been doing for decades. They just couldn't make the coal plants pay for other types of energy.
Okay, so we have costs, we have political significance, we have regulatory significance. Is there anything else?
Yes, another issue. Has Congress considered and rejected giving the agency this specific authority? Here's what they said about that in Brown and Williamson.
Congress has directly spoken to the question at issue and precluded the FDA from regulating tobacco products. Congress has created a distinct regulatory scheme for tobacco and squarely rejected proposals to give the FDA authority over tobacco.
She's saying Congress had literally voted down bills to allow the FDA to do this. And in West Virginia, Robert said something similar.
Finally, we cannot ignore that the regulatory writ EPA newly uncovered conveniently enabled it to enact a program that long after the dangers posed by greenhouse gas emissions had become well known, Congress considered and rejected multiple times. At bottom, the Clean Power Plan essentially adopted a cap-and-trade scheme or set of state cap-and-trade schemes for carbon. Congress, however, has consistently rejected proposals to amend the Clean Air Act to create such a program. So if Congress has looked at this exact question and said no, that's a strong signal that it's a major question.
Yes. There's also another factor that's clear in West Virginia. Does the agency's interpretation involve some sort of fundamental policy question that the court thinks Congress should address?
So, like, some decisions are just too important for society for us to leave the courts. We expect our elected representatives, not agencies, to make them. Like restructuring the entire energy sector.
Yes. So Robert said EPA was essentially choosing America's energy future. And that's the kind of thing that Congress should be doing, not agency bureaucrats interpreting vague statutory language.
Okay. So to summarize these factors, billions in economic impact, political controversy, novel use of old authority, Congress having considered and rejected it, and fundamental policy questions.
Right. Those are the big ones. And you can see how both of these cases at least arguably hit all of them. There is a question, however, if a case doesn't hit all of them. Is two of these factors enough? Is three? The court hasn't said.
Well, that seems problematic.
It is really problematic because this means that agencies won't know in advance where the line is. And that's also because there are really two versions of the major questions doctrine.
So two flavors of the major questions doctrine. I'm assuming that there are flavors that are more favorable to agencies and flavors that are less favorable to the agencies.
Yes, you could say that. So the first version we're going to call the weak version. This says if an agency is claiming power over a major question, courts should be skeptical. They should interpret the statute narrowly and not assume that Congress meant to delegate significant authority unless the statute clearly says so.
So it's about how the courts read the statute.
Yes, it's just an interpretive tool. The strong version is a lot more aggressive. It says that if something qualifies as a major question, ordinary statutory authorization isn't enough. Congress has to provide extraordinarily clear statutory authorization, like a clear statement rule. So even if the statute unambiguously seems broad enough to cover this, the courts would require Congress to speak with increased clarity, extraordinary clarity, one might say. We think of this in terms of the babysitter. You tell the babysitter, make sure the kids are safe. Under the weak version, she can't build a fence around your entire yard. We're going to read the instructions narrowly. It means keep an eye on them, don't let them play with knives. But even though building a fence could help keep them safe, because it's questionable whether that's what you meant, they would assume you didn't. But under the strong version, even if you said, do whatever you think is necessary to keep them safe, she still can't install the fence unless you say so explicitly. Because this would be such a major decision, one you'd expect the parents to make.
So the strong version says, don't just look at the text, ask whether Congress would really hide a huge power inside the ordinary words it used.
Yes. And that's the version we're going to be talking about next time. So next time on Administrative Remedies, we will pick up where this stopped and continue our exploration of the Major Questions Doctrine.
So that does it for today's episode on Administrative Remedies. Thank you for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this podcast and enjoy this episode, give us a like on Spotify, iTunes, or whatever platform you're listening on. And be sure to tune in next time where we'll continue to dive into the contours of administrative law, because remember, you can't fix what you don't understand.